The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we have a full house in the podcast studio this week. Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, will be leading us through the latest tech business stories as changes at the top of the biggest companies on the web ricochet around Wall Street. Jemima Kish, The Guardian's digital media reporter, will tell us what it means for the business of the web when an organization best known for publishing photos of cute kittens with silly captions manages to raise $30 million in investment. And when the BBC, Europe's largest web content publisher, fires 25% of its online staff. Charles, Jemima, are we doomed?
Not doomed. At an interesting turning point, but we'll talk about that a bit later on.
We will be talking about that a bit later on. Charles, your view, are we doomed?
Or is this no, just I'm simply looking forward to the merger of the BBC News Online site and ICANN has Cheeseburger, which I think will be quite interesting.
ICANN has headline. I can only imagine.
I think we should just hand them all over to Rupert Murdoch now and sort of cut it.
Rupert.
Pol Pot murder. No.
Suddenly this has turned into the media podcast. Well, we'll be moving quickly on. We'll also hear from the man behind the fastest growing resource for coders. Yes, that's computer programmers. Technology here. Stack Overflow about the trends in social search and answer. So keep listening to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First, here's this week's news. It's been all change at the top of the internet pile as a new year brings shifts of rank and file of both Apple and Google. Apple's much-loved CEO Steve Jobs has announced that he will be taking medical leave, the third time in the past decade, leaving his second-in-command, Tim Cook, in charge of the technology company. Jobs, whose ill health has been the subject of much speculation, has been diagnosed and treated for a rare yet treatable form of pancreatic cancer. Lucky guy. His most recent medical leave was in 2009, almost 2 years to the day of the announcement last week. Charles, how has the announcement affected Apple's stock price?
Well, Apple timed it very carefully. They made the announcement on a Monday, which was Martin Luther King Day in the US, so that the stock markets would be closed. And they had their financial results coming out on the Tuesday evening after the markets were closed. So in Frankfurt, where the shares are being traded, they dipped by about 6%, but they regained it, and Apple then had some stonking financial results, and the stock price basically wasn't affected, and it was actually very noticeable. None of the analysts on the earnings call asked about Steve Jobs or his health at all, which, to be honest, came across as very pusillanimous. They really should have been pushing the company about it.
I think Apple have really set themselves up for a fall here, because Steve Jobs is undoubtedly more closely personified with Apple than any other company I can think of. But at the same time, they don't put anyone out there. They don't. You hardly ever hear any interviews with anyone else. They just Jonathan Ive. Obviously, there'll be massive interest in getting press over here, but they're not interested in doing that. And I think there's this kind of built-in obsolescence maybe with Apple that is now tied to Steve Jobs, and it's a very risky strategy. I think if they'd opened themselves a bit more and shown some of the talent, which they clearly have, they'd be in a better position.
But at the same time, Charles, don't you think that the fact that Steve Jobs does keep taking a back seat, you know, albeit for medical leave, means that this is a slow weaning process that will put the company in good stead when he does eventually leave the company for good. And as Jemima says, more personalities are being showcased because he's simply not in the office.
Well, when it comes to people actually doing the upfront stuff, Apple has been doing a bit more of that at its announcement. I mean, it's a company which has decided, for good or ill, that it's going to simply let its products do the talking for the main part. It doesn't put people out there for interviews. The last appearance by Steve Jobs really publicly was on its earnings call of last year, around about October or so, when he vented on tablets. Really, what they're looking to do is simply say, well, this is what we do. Here it is. But they have people like Phil Schiller, who's the vice president in charge of marketing, who's been there for as long as Jobs. Jobs recruited him back from an outside company when he rejoined in 1997. They got Scott Forstall, who's the guy who's in charge of iPhone software, Tim Cook as well, who's the chief operations officer, who's going to be doing the day to day stuff. Does occasionally appear on the stage. But you know, if you were going to call any of them the sort of showman, the sort of person who can actually hold a crowd, Phil Schiller actually comes closest to it. I've seen him do some of the big exhibitions, the big sort of conference keynotes, and he's actually very funny, and he has a good style with it. So it's a different style from Jobs. But yeah, they do have to wean themselves off. They do have to find a new identity, and I think that actually they're going to need to find that sooner rather than later.
Well, the other more dramatic and unexpected shuffle is happening just down the road from Apple at Google. Eric Schmidt, the boisterous and media-friendly CEO who joined the company in 2001, has announced that he will be handing over the day-to-day operations of the search giant to the less public and, frankly, less media-savvy co-founder, Larry Page. Page, who is the 38-year-old computer programmer whose friendship and partnership with Sergey Brin during their PhD course at Stanford University turned the pair into multi-billionaires, will take over from Schmidt on the 4th of April. Charles, why now?
Well, again, this was timed to go with the announcement of Google's financials, which were all very good. You know, revenues were up by something like 27%. Profits were up by about the same amount. So clearly, Google was expecting that the market wouldn't like this. They were expecting, I think, that the analysts wouldn't like it. Instead, on the earnings call, the analysts said, yeah, great, congratulations on the move. And you know, no one actually quizzed them very hard about why this was seen to be necessary. So again, you know, rather pusillanimous by the Wall Street analysts. I mean, I think if they'd had a few journalists there, it might have been a more interesting back and forth. As to why now, well, Schmidt has not been happy with the decision that Page and Brin made to pull out of China last year after Google was hacked, apparently by hackers working on the sort of instruction, let's say, of the Chinese government. And he felt that China was a huge opportunity which simply couldn't be ignored, and Page and Brin felt that there was actually a question of principle at stake. So ever since that, which happened in about January last year, he's been thinking about other things. There's been rumours in the past few days that he was looking at some sort of TV presentation. And also, although he tweeted what you could see as either a very ironic or a very grumpy, or, you know, it's rather hard to read the sort of meta things in the tweets. He said, you know, no need of adult supervision. Well, okay, that's sort of true. But equally, Google does actually need to get, I think, to get a tighter culture going. Okay, so it throws up lots of products and it expects lots of products to fail. But If you keep on doing that when you're getting to the size that it is, then you start to look like you don't actually have any strategy at all. You don't quite know what you're there for. And you start to look like Microsoft, which people say, great business, generates loads of cash, has fantastic cash cows, but actually where is it going after that?
I was less interested in the hand-holding, although that's very interesting. When they were here for Zeitgeist, Eric Schmidt and Larry Page were together, and their back and forth is actually very entertaining, and they clearly get on really well. But Eric Schmidt's talk show, this is the talk of the town. This was in the New York Post. Apparently he did a trial for CNN in August, and it was a bit rubbish. But, you know, he's incredibly knowledgeable. He's got great contacts. He's a good presenter. I think it could work.
Well, Jemima, Duncan Watkins on Twitter actually did ask what should be next for Google CEO. Do you think a career in the spotlights with some grease paint?
Hell yeah. Why not? Get the airbrush makeup on.
I'm looking forward to him being in the I'm a Celebrity, getting me out of it, actually.
Well, you know, he could go the normal path. He could go to another company. He'll be in demand. But let's face it, he doesn't need the money because he got a $100 million payoff from Google.
He was already a billionaire, though.
So, Charles, what effect do you think Page's return to the CEO position will have on the running of the company? You mentioned in one of your articles covering this that his attitude is much more innovative. He's a hacker. You know, he's much more he'll consolidate and he'll sort of create product more than Schmidt did. And this is perhaps something that Jemima was referring to as well.
Well, yeah, Page is indeed. He's more of a hacker. He's the sort of guy who surfs the webs and says, oh, here's a nice company, let's buy that. Whereas Schmidt was maybe a bit sort of more long-term strategy, touchy-feely, sort of, hey, this is how the world is going. But equally, you know, Page and Brin bought Android and then came and told Schmidt that they'd bought it. They bought Google Earth and said, yeah, we bought this company for a few million. I mean, for Google, which has got $35 billion in the bank, doesn't make a great deal of difference. But there is that sort of dangerous feeling where the company gets too big and the message starts to get diluted, and people and you get the thing that Google is really scared of, which is that you start hiring the people who are not the best, and you buy the companies which are not the best. And how do you then have a culture where you actually say, no, this isn't up to scratch, and you fire people? That's when it starts to get a bit tough, and that's when people start to look around and get a bit worried. You know, a lot of other companies have gone through this process, you know, Microsoft particularly, Apple a little bit, Yahoo enormously, and it's how you react to that, and it's how you actually bring the company back to the sort of innovative things that gave it its original kick. How do you do that? So he needs to, I think, instill a tougher culture, maybe.
And so what do you think that Google's next CEO should do, which was actually the question Duncan Watkins asked on Twitter?
He should get the company thinking more tightly about what the hell its overall strategy is. You know, why is Google there? The answer is, I think, is to get everyone on the internet, because it dominates the internet. You know, if there's a place where Apple isn't strong, if there's a place where Microsoft isn't strong, which is sort of, you know, the two principal contenders, you could argue, it's in just extracting money out of the internet. And Google does that fantastically well. So really, its target should be to get everyone using Android handsets, everyone using Google search, you know, and down the torpedoes and go ahead with that.
And if they're not going to do social, then what are they going to do to combat it?
Well, providing the new Google CEO's first hurdle, the intellectual property lawyers at Google and Oracle have gone into hyperdrive as new details about a potential copyright breach emerged over the past few weeks. The claims are that Google's open source Android operating system for mobile phones includes code that belongs to Oracle, acquired when they swallowed Sun Microsystems in 2009. Charles, what's the latest on this?
Well, Florian Mueller, who is a... What should I say? He's an analyst who looks at what's going on with patents, and who's very interested in free and open source software, has been examining files in various versions of Android. And he says that he has found headers in those files which indicate that they came from Sun Microsystems, that they've been used without the proper permissions, and that therefore they break their copyright infringements. I mean, the Oracle suit, which was filed last summer against Google on part as the creator of Android, or the owner of Android now, is all to do with very complicated issues to do with patents, very complicated issues to do with copyright. But the thing about it is that if Oracle wins it, if it prevails, then it could, in one example, it could say, okay, Google, you are not allowed to sell any more Android handsets. Far more likely it's going to say, okay, Google, pay us some money and pay us a little stipend on every handset that includes Android on it, every handset that was sold with Android.
It's a nice little earner,
isn't
it?
Little earner.
Which is the sort of thing that Larry Ellison, being Larry Ellison, and, you know, he's quite an ambitious man.
Well, that Learjet didn't pay for itself, did it?
Exactly.
So could this have been an intention? Could this have been an accident? Could the integration of this code, which, as you've reported, Charles, the headers say things like confidential, do not use, this is ours, get your filthy mitts off it, open source programming people. Or do you think this was intentional?
To some extent, it doesn't matter. It could be an accident. It could be the sort of thing where someone automates it and they add headers onto the top, or they've sort of taken stuff and it's, you know, the ways that coders can set up things to automate the process of putting things into file trees and source trees is actually, it's easy to make that sort of mistake if it's a mistake. Some of the people who've been analyzing what Mueller has been analyzing say, well, these are just test files. You just use them for unit tests, so it's not important. Mueller's response to that is, doesn't matter, actually. If it's licensed to Sun, and if they haven't given permission for it to be included in other distributions there under other licenses, that's still an infringement. But it doesn't matter. You know, if it is an infringement, then intent doesn't come into it. It simply is what it is. So that's not very important. The case is going to take some time to be heard, and it's going to drag on and drag on. But it's one of those sort of, you know, clouds hanging over Android. It's not a very big cloud, you've got to say. It's not going to mean that you know, the Android handset in your pocket is going to suddenly cost, you know, £200 where it used to cost 10. It's far more that it's going to mean for the handset makers that they're going to say, okay, well, maybe we'll go with Windows Phone 7 for this amount of our handsets, and we'll go with Android for that number of our handsets.
Well, speaking actually about the handset manufacturers, you mentioned that, you know, Google and Android may have to pay a stipend for every time that it's included on a handset. Will this actually have any implications for the handset manufacturers who have been using Android on their phones? In other words, could they potentially also be liable for paying out stipends to Oracle, even though they didn't realize that that Android had allegedly infringed the copyright?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, though I'm obviously hoping to get a part in London law or something.
You can't handle the truth, Charles.
Yeah, that's right. But my understanding would be that if the handset manufacturers have used that copyrighted code and stuff that they've sold, then that's an infringement as well. So they become liable. It's interesting, for example, that Microsoft gives handset manufacturers who use Windows Phone 7, it says to them, okay, we give you a protection against anyone who tries to sue you over patent infringement. That's one of the things that they say Android doesn't give them. So possibly Google might have to use some of its $35 billion of cash pile to start indemnifying handset makers against any sort of patent lawsuits that emerge out of this one. And it'd be the sort of thing that actually would make a lot of handset manufacturers feel rather happier about Android.
Do you think it's possible that, knowing how much money Google has in the bank, people have been very carefully trawling through various corners of its operation?
Well, it makes a hell of a lot more sense to sue Google with $35 billion than it does to try to sue Joe Schmo. Yeah, obviously, whenever some big open source project gets successful, then people who've got patents of whatever sort start to look around at it. I mean, there's a similar issue with WebM and the VP8 video codec, which Google is open sourcing. The question is not really if, but when are there going to be some patent lawsuits filed against that?
Well, next up, it feels like it's 1999, during the era when Silicon Valley's VCs funded bizarre projects simply because they looked profitable in the short term, despite any real sustainability. Cheeseburger Network. Cheeseburger, I should emphasize the Z there. The umbrella company that owns the IP and content platform for websites like lolcats and fail blogs and other internet fads has raised $30 million in funding from several investors, including the group who coughed up for game developer Zynga, the company behind Facebook sensation Farmville. Jemima, why? Why? Okay, I appreciate lolcats. I appreciate Failblog as somebody who appreciates internet memes, but why on earth is Cheeseburger Networks a wise investment?
Well, we're talking about it. I mean, it's great profile for the venture companies that did it. And frankly, if you've got a portfolio of 20 companies and they're all very worthy, very solid business ideas, and, there's a good chance that, three or four of them are going to make it and get you a serious return on investment, why not take a punt on something that is massively high profile, if not a big money spinner?
But it's content. How do you make the money back? How do you get your exit as a VC? How do you make the sort of enormous, having dumped $30 million into Cheeseburger? Well, for any sensible VC, they're looking for an exit which is double that, at least.
I think they didn't really need the investment. If you look at Ben Hur, who's the guy that started the network, Ben Hur.
Lucky dude.
I bet he has the knives on his car wheels, doesn't he?
Maybe. He started the whole lot with $2.25 million, and he's bootstrapped since then, and it's been profitable from the start. It is a bit saturated with advertising, the lolcats site, that is, icanhascheeseburger.com, which I can never find because I can never remember how to misspell it. but look at the traffic this company gets across the network of nearly 50 sites, 16.5 million unique users in a month. Now, that's half what The Guardian gets, and I can assure you we cost a lot more to run than that network. 375 million page views, which is advertised, or rather optimised with advertising quite heavily, and they also sell T-shirts and that kind of stuff. But those are pretty good stats, I think, for a company that doesn't make its content either.
But it is impossible to identify when a meme or a fad is going to be successful. It really, truly is. I've seen companies who've tried to do it. I've seen social trending companies that trawl the web and try and predict this and that and the other.
But actually, I think they play a large part in taking those memes to the mainstream. I mean, they picked up on the fact that people were using fail in the gaming world, and they really took that to the mainstream. And that's just a very well, well expressed internet incarnation of that meme, and the fact that that term was in broad use everywhere. They turned it into a site that anyone could use and understand and made money with it. So good luck to them.
I suppose there is still a bigger audience. When we say they took it into the mainstream, we do mean
the web
our happy, yes. happy little community of geeks and freaks who enjoy these types of things. Mm. There is still the potential for, you know, lolcats
properly monetize, because you have this, you know, okay, you've got a bazillion page views, but you can't squeeze more money out of those pages by putting more ads on them. You know, the more inventory you put on, actually the lower your cost per ad goes, which makes it really hard to generate the money. And I'm still not seeing how the VCs are faintly expecting, you know, because there must have been something resembling a vague business plan when the guy pitched them.
Well, I think the most telling remark came from one of the heads of Madrona Venture, who's one of the three companies that invested in it. He said, "I've always loved cheeseburger." So I just thought, well, yeah, okay. It's just a sort of vanity investment. But no, I have no idea how they're going to make that money back.
You can understand.
Yeah, I'll have that for a dollar. Well, we'll have more on what makes a successful internet fad in the coming weeks. And finally, very briefly, the BBC announced a whopping 25% reduction in its online staff this week, the unfortunate realization of the cuts that were announced in summer last year. Jemima, you were at the press conference on Monday. What are the details?
Well, this is a very well-wrapped-up restructure of the BBC. They're cutting 360 jobs from their department of more than 1,000 staff, and they're cutting 25% of the budget. So it's really bad news. They are doing some good stuff with restructuring what was a very messy department. There are lots of kind of dead-end domains, which are bbc.co.uk/littledorrit, for example. So they're cutting 200 of those. Nobody's going to argue with that. I think the more worrying thing, on top of a pretty sensible restructure, is that they have said that they're going to meet with industry twice a year. On the surface, I think that sounds quite good, until you think, well, hang on, is this just the BBC checking that it's okay, that it does something interesting? Do you mind? Do you all mind? Okay, well, we're going to go and do it now. That is not the bold vision of the technology of the future that we expect from the BBC.
And in addition, it has a very important public service remit in order to create interactive content that does not have a commercial outlay.
I keep saying this, but both Channel 4 and the BBC in moments of crisis retrench back into television and radio. The BBC's remit is to inform, educate and enlighten. That says nothing about television. And I think if they're going to continue to be as ambitious and as influential as they need to be for our national culture, then they have to innovate, and they're not going to do that with a technology department that is massively cut back. They should be setting a precedent for the technology industry, just as they did with BBC News Online 10 years ago. I don't think they'd be able to achieve that level of impact now with the state that the technology department is in.
Well, you can read up on these stories and more, including what Amazon's acquisition of Love Film means for how we'll consume movies in the future, at guardian.co.uk/technology. Social Search and Answer, essentially a system that personalizes crowdsourcing, has been a popular initiative for many digital entrepreneurs in this Web 2.0 ecosystem. Apparently, it's been on the horizon since Yahoo Answers opened its doors in 2005, if not before. But it's been a tough nut to crack. Like online social networks, social searching relies on its audience, and building a great system does not mean that they will come. Yet, Joel Spolsky believes that he has the answer. Along with Jeff Atwood, he founded Stack Overflow, a service that reaches out to a very specific audience, computer programmers, and provides them with exactly the audience and the answers that they need. Specialization, he argues, is key. Charles spoke with Joel and began by asking how the site got going.
We started out as a programmer question and answer site specifically, but in the last 6 months, we've been running Stack Exchange, which is a bunch of sites on other topics. other than just programming questions, everything from cooking to photography. Each site is usually a narrow vertical. So if it's a photography site, it's strictly about photography. And what we don't have is what everybody else has, is the general purpose, anything with a question mark, Q&A, where you can ask questions about Justin Bieber.
You could do Justin Bieber Exchange, I guess, couldn't you?
But probably not, because there isn't any expert knowledge associated with that. And the people that would be participating would not necessarily have any unique insights to share. So it's not really chat. It's not for fans of Justin Bieber. It's really for the people who know an answer to a specific question, usually in a domain that takes some expertise and some training and some learning.
So I can see how for programming that you're probably, you know, at a computer, right. And possibly for photography if you're doing things, and even for research maths. But for cooking, are people going to be sort of thinking that the first place they want to go is to their computer to ask a question?
If you look at cooking.stackexchange, they're mostly technique-type questions. Not so many recipes, but I think there is certainly an audience for those kinds of things. But you're right that we are pretty much limited. I don't think we're going to have taxi drivers asking for directions from other taxi drivers. I would say that the total audience of the Stack Exchange sites is going to be people who are working in an expert field that requires some knowledge, who have regular access to a computer. And that describes quite a few people, but then again, what it doesn't describe is what I would call social questioning. All the existing and much larger sites, Yahoo Answers, Answers.com, which are really around just having kind of interesting conversations with people from around the internet that happen to take the form of a question and answers.
So you're saying you're not about the interesting conversation, you're about get the damn answer.
Exactly. And we have, I would say compared to some of the other sites, we have fewer social features. So it's not about following your friends or introducing other people to questions that they might be interested in. It's really about finding the one person of a million programmers in the world who had this exact specific problem that you had with this exact specific detailed interface. And they're not going to be people that you know, and they're not going to be your friends, and they're not going to be people you can ask on Facebook. They're going to be experts working in that very specific field.
But how do you get them to come to the site?
We've created a critical mass already among programmers. And what we've done is created a process for creating new sites that ensures a critical mass on each of them. Because the problem is, if you allow questions on any topic, the chances that you'll be able to get answers to them depends on, do I have enough people that might know the answer to this question?
How do you decide if the question is not in the topic? You know, how do you decide if a programming question actually isn't? Who does the moderation there?
The entire thing is very, I hate to say Web 2.0, but it's very democratic and kind of automatic and community-driven. But the site also includes voting, and you earn reputation on the site.
How do you keep the spam off? Because spam is, you know, the constant. It's the sort of the E. coli of the internet.
As questions come in, we have literally thousands of people looking at them regularly. So we probably have 3,000 people that are literally twitching on the new questions page, looking to see what comes in, hoping for something they can answer. And if those people see spam, there's enough of them that have enough reputation to delete it in seconds.
The elephant in this room is Quora, which has sort of risen to fame over the past, it feels like the past few weeks, though they've been going for sort of a year or so. Mm-hmm. How do you see your position, the Stack Exchange position, compared to Quora?
I think that Quora is doing something utterly and completely different. We're really about the type of question that actually has a very, very specific answer. Mm-hmm. And because we limit ourselves to specific fields, you can't go on Stack Overflow or any of our Stack Exchanges and ask a question about most subjects. Most questions are considered off-topic, and that's because we don't have anybody there who can answer them.
So if I was to try to sort of encapsulate it, I guess you would say Stack Exchange is about closed answers and Quora is sort of about open answers. Not that there's anything bad in either,
No.
that's the sort of category distinction.
That's a good way of putting it, or a sort of objective versus subjective. Although, of course, you can ask an objective question on Quora. What you get on Quora a lot of times is an enormous number of questions being asked where there's nobody that can possibly answer them, either because there's nobody with expertise in that particular field on Quora right now, or because there's nobody looking at that question because there's no good routing where you can find out that you get that question, or because the question itself, while allowed, cannot possibly be answered because it's vague, argumentative, it makes assumptions that aren't true, et cetera, et cetera. The kinds of things where we would simply close the question and not allow it. And so we wind up with an extremely high ratio of questions that get answered
One of the things that Jeff Atwood has written about recently has been the fact that you make your content available on a Creative Commons license.
Yes.
Because you say, well, you know, if other people can provide it for us, we can't really claim to own it. Jeff was writing about how he had seen other sites scraping Stack Overflow and then basically ranking higher in Google for the same search.
Yeah.
What's your opinion of where that's going, of you know, what's happening with Google and search engines generally?
One of the inventions in Stack Overflow was that nobody's going to know about us. They know about Google, and search happens on Google. And I would say search happens on search engines, to be more specific, but it's well over 90%. So it's really search happens on Google. You know, one of our design principles was the user interface of Stack Overflow is Google. In other words, for most people, the way they get to Stack Overflow is they type a specific question into Google, and hopefully Stack Overflow comes up in the results because we have a good answer. If we have a good answer, that's fine. And we always felt, you know, this mechanism will work correctly because Google is an enormously successful, highly innovative, astonishingly smart company that has every financial incentive and every motivational incentive to make this work. And we sort of trusted that they would be fighting the battles of the spammers and the scrapers and so forth because they had such an enormous incentive in doing it. Because it is certainly the stated goal and the intent of Google that secondary copies not rank higher than the primary source. Now, there is a claim that Google has sort of a financial incentive, honestly, to direct people to the secondary copies because they host Google AdSense, and so there is an actual economic reason why Google would prefer people to go to the spammy site in the short term. However, of all companies that are able to separate church and state, I think Google is probably the best at that particular distinction between the, sort of the business side and the editorial side, and I cannot possibly imagine that Google would allow the quality of their search results to be tainted by something like AdSense. That to me is a sort of a conspiracy theory that is just sort of utterly inconsistent with everything I know about the founders of Google and the way the company is managed.
Joel Spolsky from Stack Overflow with Charles Arthur. Now, Charles, what does Stack Overflow and other social search facilities like Quora and Aardvark offer that's different from good old-fashioned listservs and forums with their threads and that kind of thing?
Well, I guess they bring more of a Web 2.0 feel to it with Stack Overflow. Questions can be voted or answers can be voted up and marked as, yeah, this completely answers the question. Similarly on Quora, things can be moved down, they can be moved about. Though I sort of get the feeling already that there's a bit of a sort of Wikipedia-y, you know, insider thing of, no, this should be a comment, not a question or an answer. But yeah, the thing that they don't have, that they have that forums don't have, I think, is the aim. You know, forums can degenerate into stuff where people just go, yeah, right. And last Friday I went and did this. You know, these are about, let's get an answer to this question.
Yeah, and it is interesting when you look at something like Yahoo Answers, how quickly it devolved into a bunch of teenagers asking, you know, literally asking their homework questions and hoping that they're going to get a response.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You know, how can open question sites like this, you know, not suffer from the same fate?
Well, the thing, yeah, as Spolsky said, the thing about the Stack Exchange group is they're looking for closed questions. So, you know, something to which there is a definite answer and you can say, yep, that answers the question completely. Quora is different because that's an open question sort of site. It's something where there might not be an answer. And that's the point where you might say, okay, well, if too many people are asking questions that are too open, then things start to fizzle out because you have too many unanswered questions. I mean, what Quora has going for it at the moment is it's got this very elite tech audience. It's got this very elite tech focus for the most part, and not too many people asking questions that, no one has the faintest clue about.
I think Quora is full of journalists doing their homework.
Yeah.
That's the differentiation.
Well, yeah, possibly,
it's a classic sort of community architecture, isn't it? Where you've got, you know, you've got a whole bunch of early adopters saying this is brilliant because everybody's talking to themselves and they're all using it for
sure.
Exactly the
but
same
how they
purpose.
Keep the credibility longer term is a real challenge for them, I think. It is very interesting, but it also kind of merges with search and semantic search in quite an interesting way, I think.
Well, I mean, I think that's where Stack Exchange has the potential for much more longevity, in that it can say, you come here, you get you have an answer, we say this answers this question. And so the fact that they're filtering the questions more tightly makes a big difference. Quora tries to filter your answer a bit, or sort of filter your question a bit. It says, no, don't ask questions like that. But it's not anything like the sort of brutality, I guess you'd say, of the people at Stack Exchange.
Well, listen to Tech Weekly's coverage of social searching company Aardvark from last year and follow the links to our Quora and Stack Overflow coverage on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Before we leave you for this week, there are two very exciting events happening at Guardian Towers in February. First, the Guardian's Games Blog is hosting the very first Games Blog live event with key players behind Electronic Arts' forthcoming releases. Crysis 2. See, that's why I did that. Crysis 2. Too many E's. Crysis 2, Shift 2, and Dragon Age 2. Games correspondent Keith Stewart will be hosting the day and will grill the developers about storytelling in games and the art and design behind the big hitters. Find out more at guardian.co.uk/gamesblog. Second, Jemima's been hard at work organizing Guardian Hacks South by Southwest Interactive, an event aimed at bringing together journalists and technologists in order to create the best tech to cover this year's South by Southwest Interactive event in Austin. We will have more on this event next week, but head to guardian.co.uk for more information. That's it for this week. Many thanks to Charles and Jemima for their in-studio antics.
Is this where I mentioned the rubber dress?
Yes, and the rubber dress hilarity. Jemima is wearing rubber fashion. For their in-studio antics.
We're going to get a whole new audience.
Welcome. Yes, there is a picture on Flickr and also on Twitter. Just check my Twitter stream. And to Joel Spolsky from Stack Overflow. He is not wearing a rubber dress, just for the record. I'm Alex Kratowski. This week's podcast was produced by Scott Colley. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.